Hello, I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is the very best of The Daily Show. On this bonus episode, we'll revisit the hottest topics, the best guests, the funniest interviews of the past week. So please remember to tune in to the regular show, Monday to Friday, 5 p.m. in your Mail Plus briefings, Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify. But for now, enjoy the show. MPs very upset by the decision to allow gamblers to continue betting thousands of pounds a minute on online slot games. The regulating body, the Gambling Commission, has announced new measures to tackle addictive online casino games, but fail to place caps on bids, meaning problem gamblers can still lose up to, and get this figure, £2,400 in just 1 minute. Joining me now is Carolyn Harris. She's chairwoman of the all-party parliamentary group for gambling, and she's the Labour MP for Swansea East. Carolyn Harris, there's been such a big push on the against the gambling companies. I'm surprised the Gambling Commission was so feeble, frankly.
I'm astounded, Andrew. I mean, it just seems to me that there was a golden opportunity here for them to put in the correct measures to tackle this, the pernicious consequences of gambling. I've just come off a Zoom call with somebody who's likely to go to jail on Friday because of these slots and stealing in order to fund the gambling. And I just cannot believe that the Gambling Commission have missed this opportunity to do the right thing.
Do you think they're just kowtowing to them, to the gambling industry, which is powerful, and because it's so feeble, their response?
Well, I mean, I've been very critical of the Gambling Commission over since I've got involved in looking at gambling. And I always feel that they go so far and they get scared and they hold back. And that's been half the problem, is they're not prepared to cross the line and actually do the right thing right to the nth degree where it would really have more impact. We've seen it with the way they investigate the industry. We've seen it by the way that they don't investigate complaints they receive from vulnerable people. There's something that really bothers me about their inability to complete on anything. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. I've always said they're not fit for purpose, and that, I mean, I welcomed a lot of what they'd said yesterday, but the bit that really would have made a massive difference was this business about the caps. We did it with FOBTs. We proved that by reducing the stake on FOBTs, whilst we can't stop people having an addiction to gambling, we can stop the economic and the social consequences of losing the amounts of money that people can currently lose. We've done it before, and hopefully we'll do it again. But the Gambling Commission really frustrate me.
And the FOBTs, of course, are fixed odds betting machines, and that you got those cut the wages from £100 to £2, but these slot games, these online slot games, you can still pay up to £100 per spin, and that means losses could hit £2,400 a minute every 20 seconds. Well,
it's unbelievable, isn't it? And we saw the consequences of them when the land-based, and we eventually got the government to see sense. They have to do this online, otherwise it's just a waste of energy that what they did yesterday will not really have any good effect.
And do we know how young some of the people may be playing these games? Because how do they possibly enforce any rules on age rules?
Well, they say they do check age, and there is a criteria that they say that they follow. But if I tell you that 62,000 children between the ages of 11 and 16 are addicted gamblers, they're going somewhere to gamble. And I don't for 1 minute think they're walking in the bookies and putting it on a horse. So they're going online, you know. So you've got to ask yourself, how stringent are these checks? And even if you're playing a child's game, the adverts for casinos and slots that come up on even a child's game are terrifying. So it's everywhere they go, they're tempting people into the gambling situation.
62,000. How old are those young people that you say are gambling addicts?
Between 11 and 16.
Shocking. It's absolutely shocking, isn't it? Yeah. And there's also, just finally, Carolyn, of course, we know that some people get into such a state with their gambling and their debts. Unfortunately, they take the only way out they think is the only way out, and they take their own lives.
Yeah. And that's been a consequence for far too many people. We see more people going to prison for committing crimes, for gambling in order to fund it. We've seen people taking their lives. It's a mental and a public health issue. We've got to start treating these people, not persecuting them. And one way to do that is to make sure the industry is held accountable for their practices and the way that they deal with people who quite obviously have got a problem. And there's a whole raft of things we need to do, but reducing the stake on land would have been online would have been a wonderful step in the right direction.
Certainly would. That's Carolyn Harris. She's chairwoman of the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Gambling, and she's the Labour MP for Swansea East. And I just suspect she's going to be on those gambling companies' tails for quite a long time ahead. So, according to government scientists, Britain is finally past the peak of the latest wave of coronavirus. That's according to the government's chief scientist, Chris Whitty. Boris Johnson holds out the hope that a plan for lifting lockdown, or certainly a route map, will be published on February the 22nd. The hospitality industry, which has been brought to its knees by the pandemic, have welcomed the move, but say pubs and restaurants in particular need specific dates because, of course, they have to plan in advance. Joining me to talk about this is Sasha Lord, who is the nighttime economy advisor for Greater Manchester and co-founder of the Part Life Festival and Warehouse Project. Sasha Lord, we talked about this so many months ago, the impact on the hospitality industry. Devastating is presumably the only word you can use. I work in London, live in London. I can see for myself what it's like. How bad is it in Greater Manchester?
Well, your word's correct. It's absolutely devastating. We've been given such a hammer blow. There has been some support, but, you know, sadly, we've seen many, many closures, mass job losses. And we know for a fact that possibly up to 4 in 5 businesses haven't got the cash to get through this month.
That's a dramatic figure.
Substantial. It's very concerning. And we're urging now that the Chancellor on the 3rd of March and the next budget, you know, please extend the VAT reduction, please extend the business rates relief, and please extend furlough too, until we can operate it 100%.
And 4/5 of businesses in your area that haven't got the money to get through another month or two, how many jobs does that represent, do you think?
To be honest, I couldn't tell you. I know there's 420,000 people who used to work in the nighttime economy in Greater Manchester. Those numbers have been dramatically reduced. But, you know, one thing I would say, Andrew, is look, since lockdown and being somebody who's come from the hospitality sector all my life, 26 years, I've been the first one to shout and scream and not the government. But actually, what a fantastic job they are doing of this rollout of the vaccine.
They certainly are, yeah.
Incredible, far, far better than my expectations. So, you know, hats off. It's, you know, for once we can say it's world leading. It really is. It's incredible.
But does that give you hope too, that the vaccination rollout thus far going very well, no sign anytime soon it's going to stutter. Does that give you hope soon that they can then publish a roadmap out of the lockdown? Because as you say, your members, pubs and restaurants need specific dates because not least they've got to get booze in, food in, staff in, all the rest of it.
No, you're quite right. And I think it showed the last time they asked us to reopen how they didn't quite understand the hospitality industry. You know, you cannot open a pub with 3 days notice or a restaurant. You've got to order the food. You've got to order the stock. You've got to clean the pipes, reroad to retrain staff and put new measures in place. So it simply wasn't achievable. And many couldn't open the last time round or not on the proposed date anyway. So I think the good news that I listened very, very carefully yesterday to the Prime Minister's conversation when he came out at 5 o'clock. And one of his questions, he did specifically say he would give dates on this route map out on the 22nd of February. And that was very, very encouraging for the sector, because if we do have a date, then it's something that we can work towards.
And you have your own input, you have your own way into government. The impact, if money isn't forthcoming in the budget, Sasha Lord, what's going to happen? Are those 4/5 of businesses you talk about, are they not going to reopen?
My honest feeling is if we have not got a date, then yes, the majority won't. If we are given a date, Andrew, and this, I'm just saying, for example, this isn't a solid date. If they turn around and say, okay, the 1st of April, if everything goes as it should, will be able to open food-led restaurants and pubs at 50% capacity, then that's something we can work towards and stretch towards. And I'm sure there can be conversations with banks and lenders how to get there. But if there's not clarity and transparency, then yes, people are just going to give up. You know, there's a bigger picture here as well from operators I'm talking to. It's not just about the cash in the bank or lack of it. It's people's mental health. You know, they've gone through this since the 20th of March last year. You know, and people have just had enough of this roller coaster. They cannot handle it. And to be completely blunt, we are now very, very sadly seeing suicides. And there's three people I know myself who tragically have taken their own lives.
Very depressing. Just finally, Sacha Lord, which is most badly affected? Is it restaurants, pubs, or is it impossible to tell the difference?
No, I can pinpoint it exactly. So in tier two, you were allowed to open if you were serving food. We'll all remember this debate about this ridiculous scotch egg with a pickle or garnish.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Absolute nonsense. So, you know, what I'm saying now is when we can reopen, what about those wet-led pubs? Most of those pubs are actually, they are community pubs in our most deprived areas. And in Greater Manchester, there's 1,806 of them. So why is it right that I can go to a restaurant with social distancing, all those measures in place, I can have a few drinks, have lunch, but people that live in our most deprived areas, the lowest paid, they can't, even though all those measures will still be in place. So that doesn't really seem fair to me. It felt almost a bit of an attack on class culture. So they're the ones who are being really hit hard, and they're the ones that don't just serve a pint. You know, they actually serve the local community.
All right, that's Sacha Lord. He's the nighttime economy advisor for Greater Manchester, co-founder of Part Life Festival and, of course, the Warehouse Project. Thanks for joining us.
So the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine, great news. It may lead to a substantial fall in COVID infections. That's according to major research, which is published, which suggests a single shot reduces positive cases by 67% and, crucially, also prevents people passing on the virus. So is this now the holy grail for ending lockdown? Joining me to discuss this is Dr. Barrett Pankhania, who's senior clinical lecturer at the University of Exeter Medical School. Dr. Pankhania, this is good news, isn't it? It's respected research, it's detailed research, and it suggests that this vaccine really is highly effective.
At this point in time, for the parameters under which the paper was written, it is good news. The better news is that we have established several vaccines which appear to work and create immunity and immune memory. So it is good news from several platforms appearing to work.
Does this strengthen the government's case for, it incurred quite a lot of controversy at the time, for giving out one jab, getting a maximum one jab into people's arms straight away rather than getting people two jabs, as I know Pfizer would have preferred, and perhaps possibly even Oxford-AstraZeneca?
Yes, so it was a good move. And the reason why I put it in that way is we are in the middle of a crisis. And because we are in the middle of a crisis with a limited supply of vaccines, a better public health strategy is to immunize as many people as possible, as fast as possible. And therefore, instead of using two vaccines separated by 3 weeks, we're using one vaccine to double up and immunize all those people. And then at the 3 month stage, we will also give them their second vaccine. So it is a win-win and a good, smart move to cover as many people as possible, as fast as possible, with the single vaccine jab.
And the other positive part that we now think for the first time, or we know for the first time, if you agree with that, Doctor, that the vaccine limits people spreading the virus too.
Yes, so the additional information that we have with the paper published by the Oxford group is that by giving the immunization, people appear to be protected to such an extent that they are not onward transmitters of infection. So in some cases, with some vaccines, we actually achieve this. And it is good to see that the Oxford-AstraZeneca one is also achieving it in a large number of people, whereby the vaccine not only protects them, but also prevents them from being infectious agents.
What have some people listening to the podcast, Doctor, will be concerned because the French president, who whether he's being political or not, he's in France. They're insisting that the AstraZeneca vaccine should not be given to people over the age of 65 because they don't think the research done on that age group is large enough and extensive enough. Now, Britain is giving that vaccine, as you know, to everybody. And the European Union, even though they've got themselves into a terrible lather and a terrible mess over their vaccine rollout programme, also says it's safe for people over 65. It's damaging, isn't it, when a head of state like a French president suggests otherwise, with no proper evidence?
We have a lot of these utterances from all manner of people from all manner of backgrounds. The key point here, and it is very important for us to understand this key point, is that the European Union said we haven't got the evidence. The United Kingdom regulatory body said empirically we feel it will work, despite the fact that it hasn't been tested extensively in the older age group. So both people are right. Both people have got a point, but both of them can look at it in a different way. And so the United Kingdom took the line of, on the basis of biology and working from first principles, we feel it will work, and they've gone ahead and done it. The German authorities were looking at it and saying, well, we haven't got the evidence that it works. But at the same time, of course, we haven't got the evidence that it doesn't work.
Yes,
there are fine nuances, and we should discuss both of them. It's good to discuss and debate.
Indeed. And Doctor, we know there's been all sorts of problems with test and trace and various other aspects of the government's public health programme in relation to COVID, but the rollout of the vaccine seems to be going remarkably well. Do you have advice, though, too, for people who are listening, that even if they've had the first jab, that they have to continue to be mindful of the fact the vaccine is, that the virus is still out there, and they should observe social distancing and stay at home as much as they can?
Oh, yes, very much so. So the important messages are that when you receive the vaccine, you are getting an additional shield of protection in addition to all the other things you have been doing, wearing your mask properly, avoiding crowds, avoiding getting close to people, avoiding poorly ventilated places. And really, you must continue with all of those infection control measures because our case numbers are very high. And what you don't want to do is, even if you are immunized, you could be infectious to others. And if that is the case, you could be infecting people who have not been immunized as yet. Therefore, it's very, very important that everyone continues with infection control measures in these early stages of the vaccine rollout. Later on, when the case numbers are lower, inevitably we will be able to reduce and remove some of the restrictions that we've got.
All right. That's Dr. Bharat Pankhania, Senior Clinical Lecturer at the University of Exeter Medical School. Thanks for joining us. Now, why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk and listen to The Daily Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Two-thirds of people in Britain are retraining in the hope of finding different jobs because of the pandemic, of course. This is according to new research by the Reed Employment Agency. Almost all of those surveyed, 93%, plan to put their newfound skills to find work this year. I'm joined now by James Reed, who is the chairman of Reed Employment Agency. Mr. Reed, it's very encouraging, isn't it? Rather than getting down in the dumps about the fact they may have lost their job or they may be down in the dumps about being locked down, people are going online and finding ways to look for new opportunities and to retrain.
It's really striking, Andrew. Yes, I think it's a very different approach this time than we might have seen in previous recessions. And I think it's because it's possible to do so much online now. There's an amazing array of courses, really short courses and longer term courses leading to qualifications that you can access at the click of a button. So people are really using that now. And it's really interesting what they're studying. There's sort of a huge range of things that people are studying, some of which are sort of for their own personal development and some of which are for professional purposes. But I think it's a really enriching opportunity for a lot of people, especially as we're so locked in at the moment. When you're locked in and locked down, it's a good time to learn something new.
What sort of interesting things could you single out that they're studying, whether it is for their own personal benefit or for professional reasons?
Well, it's worth pointing out on our website, on read.co.uk, we've got over 55,000 courses listed. And most of those courses are either free or cheap. I mean, they don't cost very much. So I think 88% of the courses that we sell are less than £20. They're very accessible. And looking at the ones that the top five paid for courses are really interesting. I mean, the number one paid for course in the last 30 days is British Sign Language, levels
really?
1 and 2. So people are learning sign language. The second one, and this is pretty telling, is Understanding Anxiety, Depression, CBT. So that tells you something about what's happening out there.
Mm.
Third is Leadership and Management. Fourth is Project Management. And fifth, Microsoft Excel Complete Course. So that gives you a big range, doesn't it?
It
certainly does. And those are the
paid-for
ones. So, and then the free courses, we've got Essential IT Skills, a free online CSCS course, which is for construction, business and administration, counseling skills, and HR fundamentals.
Pretty interesting, isn't it? Fascinating that people are learning British Sign Language in such large numbers. I guess perhaps they've got the TV on in the background. Maybe they've got News 24 on, or they've got the daily press conference, for instance, with Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister. There's always a sign language person. I think there is with the Welsh First Minister too.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think it's a skill that's useful to have because it improves your opportunities to communicate. And it's also a skill you can work from home with, isn't it? I mean, you can be actively employed as a sign language person from your own front room. So I think it's quite a clever thing to learn. And I think, you know, it's good that so many people are doing that.
Why do you think as well that, according to your research, that 2/3 or 61% anyway, of those people who made redundant last year are feeling more hopeful about their prospects this year? Is it because they can go online and retrain? What do you put it down to?
Well, I think people can see things are beginning to improve and also
right.
that they have more options perhaps than they had in the past because they can learn new skills relatively easily online. I think both those things are true. But I was just looking at our data for the last week and it's really interesting that looking at the jobs that we've taken over the last week, we've taken over 50,000 new jobs in a week, and we've taken that's 5% more jobs than we took in the corresponding week last year. So despite this lockdown, we've got more live jobs coming on now than we had a year ago. So I think the labor market is opening up. It might be hard to believe because, you know, there's so much negativity about the economy in the news. But our data, which is a leading indicator, shows that there are more opportunities coming online. So I think there are good reasons to be hopeful and good reasons to be more optimistic, certainly, than we might have felt 6 months ago.
And just to get that figure right, Mr. Reed, 50,000 jobs you've taken on in the last week compared to last year?
Yeah, and it was 5% more than last year. So it was
right.
6,000 or 7,000 last year. So yes, yeah, it's growing. And there's a huge variety of, you know, opportunities. I mean, there's no denying that the labour market has been through a huge period of turmoil and change. And a lot of people, obviously, regrettably, have lost their jobs. Other people are furloughed. But there are new jobs emerging. And, you know, we are going through a transition. But I think we're coming out of the other side now. And I think we'll see more jobs this year than last year. And hopefully it will be possible for people to get back to work quickly.
Let's hope so. That's James Reed, who is the founder of the Reed Employment Agency. Thanks so much. Bridget Jones' Diary, can you believe it, has turned 25, having sold millions of copies and spawned 3 film adaptions starring, of course, Renée Zellweger as Bridget and Colin Firth as Mark Darcy. The iconic male columnist Liz Jones freely admits the column changed her life and in part inspired her own column. And she joins me now. Liz, of course, you know and worked with Helen Fielding, who created Bridget Jones.
Yes, I worked with her on a Sunday newspaper, and we were all slightly in awe of her. She used to come into the office only on a Friday, and she would write about parties and the social scene. But she was just so nice, and she was always grateful, and she spoke to the little people like me. So that's what inspired me most of all about her, was that she was a fantastic writer, but she was very humble. And then she started writing the Bridget Jones column, and for the first time, you felt you were seen and that it was okay not to be perfect, and you weren't going to have your happy ending, and it was all about having friends who were your family. And it changed my life, and it did inspire me to be braver as a writer and to write about all my faults as well, because no one's perfect. And I think younger writers these days, they're very much, I'm fantastic, I can do anything, I'm amazing. What I liked about Helen and Bridget was they were self-deprecating and you could relate to them. She was really struggling before Bridget Jones. She could barely afford her rent. She was a struggling freelancer, and you know, it earned her so much money, but she really, really deserved it. She just changed life for so many women, and she made us laugh. And in my darkest times, I reread her books because they're like therapy. They get me through my dark times.
Do you think, I mean, she basically lampooned what people saw, you know, society's obsession with female perfection. Do you think that's why she's still so hugely popular? And I gather younger women too, she appeals to a whole generation of people under the age of 30.
Because I think she's quite rare, really, in the media. She speaks the truth. Well, if you look at most media, it's all about how wonderful people's lives are and how successful they are and how much they know about politics and how happily married they are and all their children. And I think it's because she was so flawed, that's why I think she's still relatable today. I know she was on Desert Island Discs and she said that she wouldn't be allowed to write the characters anymore because obviously yeah. Mark Darcy pinched your bottom and everything.
Yes,
but
yes.
You know, that's what was great about her. She wasn't PC, she wasn't Me Too, she was real. You know, there is still sexism in the office. Just because we don't write about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
No, quite. Now, what do you think, Liz, about the idea she had those three extraordinarily successful films? If there is a fourth film, and there's been a lot of talk about it, would your advice be for her to carry on or stop where she has, because she's been so successful? And what could Bridget Jones tell us or teach us in a fourth film? Would you watch it?
Well, it's a bit of a shame, really, because the books came up against Hollywood and they came up against Renée Zellweger. After the first two films, Renée Zellweger refused to put any weight on. She couldn't do it again. So in the third film, Bridget Jones's Baby, it didn't work. The humour didn't work because she was a stick insect. You know, she'd finally got to her target weight. And it only works, really, if it isn't Hollywood and it's true to what Bridget wrote. And I don't really think Bridget wanted her to be a stick insect, but Renée Zellweger just wouldn't put on the weight again. It took a terrible toll on her. So I don't really see how they can take it to a fourth film, much as I'd loved. I mean, Colin Firth just thinks he's too old now. Hugh Grant didn't do the third one because he said he was too old to be a sex symbol. But it might be interesting to see Bridget go through the menopause. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that would be interesting. And that would be also, for millions of women, it would be very, very, well, they'd relate to it, obviously, and to women who are going to face the menopause, it would be interesting too, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and I'm sure she'd be funny about it as well, rather than moaning.
Yeah, exactly. What's your hunch? Is she going to do it? What do you think? She doesn't need the money, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, it'd be lovely to have the money, wouldn't it? Yeah, but I just wonder if Renée Zellweger will do it again, and whether she put some menopausal weight on around her middle.
All right, that's Liz Jones, the fabulous Liz Jones, male columnist, talking about Bridget Jones, who is an extraordinary. Can you believe she's 25?
No, it makes you feel really old.
Yeah, but you don't look it. Great to talk to you. That's the fabulous Liz Jones. Well, that's all from the Best of the Daily Show with me, Andrew Pearce. Remember, you can tune into the regular show Monday to Friday at 5 p.m. on Apple Podcasts, Google, or Spotify. Have yourselves a great weekend, and goodbye.